Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respects to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to 3CR Breakfast. Today is Tuesday, the 24th of March, 2026. It's 7 a.m. And just a shout out to the radioactive show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. My name is Fung, and in the studio today we've got Juliet and Elena. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are we going? What did we get up to on the weekend? Anyone?
I went camping. I've been trying to go camping for about 6 months, and the weather keeps getting in the way, but I finally succeeded, so that was really nice.
Yeah, any highlights from your camping trip?
That's a good question. I went to visit a waterfall near Lawn, and that was really nice.
Yeah.
There was one girl, though, who was, like, trying to climb up this very slippery rock, and it was a bit stressful to watch.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
But she was fine, so that's good.
I love going camping where there's, like, a source of water nearby.
Yeah.
Always makes it so much nicer.
Yeah, definitely. Mm.
Well, on Saturday night, I went to a fundraising event for Free Kanaki Solidarity NAM. I spoke about it when I interviewed Kathy and Emma from that organization, but it was a documentary screening and a sort of discussion to raise funds for a delegation of Kanak women coming to so-called Australia next month. So that was really great, and just a really lovely opportunity to learn more about what's happening over there, and the ongoing disastrous impacts of French colonization. And also nice to meet people that you've interviewed in person, which, you know, sometimes we get guests in, which is really nice. But a lot of the time it's over the phone, so nice to actually see people in person. Anything from your weekend, Elena, that you want to share?
Just lots of working, lots of studies, that kind of thing. That, I feel like March is always a really busy time of year. Mm. So, yeah, just trying to keep up.
yeah, definitely. I think January and February are sort of still easing into the year. Yeah. And then, of course, with, like, uni starting, it maybe is a bit full on. Well, speaking of full on, I don't know if that was a good segue. We've got a big show for everyone today. So first up at 7:15, we'll be joined by Damien, who is a member of the Asian Migrant Sex Worker Advisory Group, and we'll be discussing the ongoing violence and discrimination against Asian migrant sex workers. This follows another gathering organised by Rising Red Lantern outside the Melbourne Magistrates Court yesterday morning, and it was a vigil held prior to the committal hearing of a man who's been charged with the rape and murder of 62-year-old Asian migrant sex worker Yuko. So we'll be speaking about that. At 7:30, we'll be joined again by Lucinda Thorpe, who's a regular contributor to 3CR Breakfast. Lucinda is privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, and she'll be on the show to talk about Australia's new online safety codes, which will now require age verification for R-rated games and websites, and the consequences that this will have on our privacy. And we'll also just chat about whether this is actually an effective way of preventing young people from accessing adult content.
And then we're going to be speaking to Catherine Noon, who's an organiser from the Save Our Community Health campaign. And last October, the government announced major cuts to inner city co-health services. And we're going to be chatting to Catherine about how this has affected the range of services available and the impact on the community.
At 8, we'll be joined in the studio by Brooke and Wilson, who are from Fairtrade Narcotics, and will be speaking about their upcoming album titled Recession Pop.
And then finally at 8.15, we'll be listening to an interview with Avril Burrows, a multidisciplinary artist who is currently exhibiting a show, Okra Ritual, at Trocadero Projects in Footscray. And we talk about the history and culture behind the vegetable and how she used it to create a range of works across mediums.
Such a varied show for today, which is really cool. So stay tuned. We'll be back with the news headlines in just a moment.
Some folks know about it, some don't.
These are the news headlines for Tuesday, the 24th of March, 2026. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei has denied that Iran held talks with the U.S., saying that Tehran's position on the Strait of Hormuz conditions for ending the war have not changed. The comments shared by the state news agency IRNA, Baghaei said that messages have been received from some friendly countries regarding the U.S. request for negotiations to end the war. Iran's responding by giving warnings about the dire consequences of any attack on Iran's vital infrastructure, Baghaei said. This comes after Donald Trump says the U.S. and Iran have held very good and productive conversations regarding a complete and total resolution of our hostilities in the Middle East. Earlier, Iran's National Defense Council said any attempt to attack the Iranian coast or islands will cause all communication lines in the Persian Gulf to be mined, as a deadline imposed by the U.S. President Donald Trump for Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz expires today. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have blown up the Qasmiya Bridge over the Litani River, a key crossing out of southern Lebanon, an attack that President Joseph Aoun, a former general, says is a prelude to a ground invasion. Also in the news, a new survey of Victorians has found strong public support for the truth-telling processes that center the voices and experiences of First Nations peoples. The research provides one of the clearest indications that a majority of the Victorian public supports formal processes to acknowledge and discuss the historical and ongoing injustices experienced by First Nations peoples. The survey is a part of a broader study conducted by Professor Emma J. Gavin, a Garwin Aboriginal scholar and the first Indigenous professor of truth-telling in Australia, and Professional Andrew Gunston, a leading international authority on reconciliation and is co-chair Reconciliation Victoria. Also looks at treaty, reconciliation, and the Uluru Statement from the Heart and the First Nations Voice to Parliament. This survey of 1,006 Victorians examined public attitudes towards truth-telling in the state. The results reveal that 65% of Victorians support truth-telling, with respondents indicating that they either agree or strongly agree that such processes should occur. In contrast, just 13% expressed opposition, while 19% remained neutral and a small portion were unsure.
In other news, Deep Cut News has revealed that the RBA governor bought a luxury four-bedroom home on the New South Wales North Coast as the Reserve Bank raised interest rates on ordinary Australians. New South Wales Land Registry records seen by Deep Cut reveal Bullock settled a property in the beach town of Yamba for $2 million $50,000 on March 17, the day that Bullock hit Australians with a second consecutive 0.25% rate rise. Bullock, who earns $1.195275 per year in her taxpayer-funded role, is among 34 public servants to be paid over $1 million. Her generous pay packet is 1,513% more than the median annual salary of an Australian worker, which is sitting at $74,100. As Bullock was settling her luxury investment home, she gave a speech on March 3rd saying the unemployment rate will probably have to rise, meaning more working Australians should lose their jobs to help counter inflation. And finally, in the headlines, students from Monash University are being taken out of the classroom and onto country, learning directly from Aboriginal elders and community organisations across Victoria as part of a redesigned intercultural unit. The program, relaunched this week to coincide with National Close the Gap Day, centres on Indigenous knowledge and self-determination, areas where progress under the national agreement remains uneven. At the Rumbalara Aboriginal Cooperative Healing Centre, Yorta Yorta Elder Auntie Sharon Jones welcomed students onto country as part of the course. "Healing starts when our mob feels seen, safe and connected," Miss Jones said. "When students sit with our elders and community, they're not just learning history, they're learning responsibility." The unit, Global Encounters, includes on-country sessions with Aboriginal organisations where students engage with community leaders, educators and local knowledge holders. Auntie Jones said programs like this were to ensure future workers understood the value of Indigenous-led approaches. "It's important students learn to respect our ways of being, living and healing," she said. These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, 24th of March. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
Staff liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
They're eyeing off an estate which is in perfectly good condition. It just happens to have bay views and a lot of open space.
Bay Views for All is a new documentary that reveals the human cost of the Victorian government's public housing redevelopment project. The film documents residents of the Barrack Beacon public housing estate as they fight to save their homes and community. Bay Views for All is available for community members, public housing advocates and organisations to screen, intending to spark conversations, raise funds and educate audiences on the importance of public housing. To organise a screening, email barrackbeacon@gmail.com. That's BARAKBEACON at gmail.com.
Save public housing! Stop the demolition!
A 3CR supporter.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinnan. I'm a proud Yorta Yorta, Jar Jar Rong, Kalkadoon, and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and 3cr.org.au. We are joined this morning by Damien, who is a member of the Asian Migrant Sex Worker Advisory Group. Damien is on the program this morning to discuss the ongoing violence and discrimination against Asian migrant sex workers. And this conversation follows another gathering organised by Rising Red Lantern outside the Melbourne Magistrates Court yesterday, where this vigil was held prior to the committal hearing of Michael James Chalmers, who's been charged with rape and murder of 62-year-old Asian migrant sex worker Yuko. Listeners, please note that the following interview will discuss violence against sex workers. If you are a migrant sex worker in need of support, you can reach out to your local peer organisation. That's Scarlet Alliance for the Peak Body at scarletalliance.org.au, or Vixen in so-called Australia at vixen.org.au. And if you need to talk to someone about the issues covered in today's episode, you can also contact Q Life on 1800 184 527. Thank you, Damien, for being on the show this morning.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
So this has been a really heavy time for the sex worker community in NAM as well as their allies. I was wondering if you could start by telling us about the vigils and gatherings that you've been putting on for Yuko and other workers who have been killed.
Yeah, so in recent year there have been many high-profile cases around the passing of members of our community who are Asian migrants, community member, who are also sex worker. And so one of those cases is the case in Rainbow Garden at Footscray of Yuko, who's passed away. And, you know, like the story is quite tragic and shortly following after the case was quite high profile with the murder charge, with manslaughter and with murder and with rape. And so when that happened, the community sort of know that the current legal system is quite fraught with no inputs from the community and is centered around what happened to the perpetrator, you know. And so we got together and started holding these gathering and vigil sort of in front of the court prior to the hearing and also occasionally over the weekends to sort of hold space for truth-telling, you know, because at the end of the day, inside the courts is about litigation between the government and the perpetrator, and it's about the perpetrator, whereas we're trying to create a space for victim-centered truth-telling. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's really clear from the vigils and gatherings that you've been putting on, is to remember each of these women as not just a worker, but also as a friend, a family member, someone who was, you know, living their life and part of a community,
yeah,
which is really important. And a lot of the times, as we see from media reports, their life is flattened into,
yeah,
you know, the work that they were doing or the fact that they were a migrant or something like that, which doesn't tell the full story. So you were just talking about the gatherings, including yesterday's one, which took place before the committal hearing for the man who has been charged with Yuko's murder. I understand that there's another gathering coming up next. So I was wondering if you could talk about that and what's next with her case.
Yeah, well, I think for just to look back at the process so far, what we have seen so far with the court case is sort of an itemization and dehumanization of members of our community, right? I think Yuko, cases like Yuchi Lua and Hung Suk Jun, these are all, you know, like real people that if we look back at any of the ruling and description, they have all been erased. And so for UGO specifically, the case had been in the committal process. What that kind of means is that the court is deciding whether or not there are enough evidence for a trial. And so next week on Tuesday, the 31st of March, the magistrate will deliver a ruling on whether or not there is enough evidence for the trial for the killer of Blake and murder. And so we're actually calling on everyone to join us as we will be holding holding a space, calling on all to gather just now before, so at 9 a.m. Next week. Yeah, we're asking everyone to come down. We're going to pack the front of the Melbourne magistrates and say that, you know, no matter what happened prior to the court case, we are telling her story, we're hearing her story, and we are having a strong presence for UGO.
Yeah. And as an advocate and peer worker supporting Asian migrant sex workers, how do you see the response to the violence against these women compared to other cases of violence against women? What does it say about, you know, our society and who we deem as worthy of justice?
Yeah, I think very good question. The justice system, the justice system is incredibly sexist. And is not a useful litigating body at all. But we've seen in the courts at the moment is a decision-making process in which there is one side is the police and government trying to prosecuting against the perpetrator. So that's already a really sticky dynamic, especially when the police is one of the main, is a quite harmful force and violent force against member of our community. Then, on top of that, is a hyper-focus on anti-immigration, on the hyper-focus on anti-sex work, rhetoric and policy that exists in the world by the Australian government. And so what we're seeing is a discrimination inside the courts and the way that the narrative are told. There's also, you know, on top of that, sort of racist and sexist narrative by the media as well, who are reporting on these cases. And so, at the end of the day, this is about justice and truth-telling. And so for the case of UGO and UGO and Hutsuchan, a lot of what we're doing is retelling the narrative of what victims of violence and members of the Asian migrant community are seen as.
Yeah, and I guess it goes back to why this advocacy and support is so important, because not only are these women suffering violence and discrimination on an interpersonal level, but as we've discussed with Bea and many others on the show before, it's happening on an systemic level by institutions, for example, like Victorian Police and Australian Border Force as well, and the courts, as you say. Given all of this, Damien, what needs to happen in order for Asian migrant sex workers to be able to work and live their lives without violence or discrimination?
Yeah, I think that this is a way bigger story, right? This is about UGO, but it's also about every single migrant, every single sex worker, every single immigrant in this country. And as sex worker, we always say we demand rights, not rescue. And what that looks like for migrants' rights is about ending border violence, so ending the raids that are happening in our home, ending the raids that are happening in our workplaces. It's about actually having accessible visa, and we've seen with the Albanese government, it's a continuation of very harsh harsh border policy, anti-migrant policy. And then there's also the sex worker rights element, which is really about fighting for full decriminalization and then also anti-discrimination protection in this country. And then there's obviously the element of women's rights and workers' rights, in which we're fighting for better pay in certain places, and we're also fighting for the rights for workers to unite and fight for a better world.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Damien. And it really just goes to show why this issue is so important and it does touch and affect everyone. So I guess that leads on to my last question. Why is it important for the broader community, not just sex workers or their direct allies, to continue showing up in support of sex workers, but especially migrant sex workers?
Yeah, I think this is about all of us, you know. Like, I think we see these stories of Yuko and Yuchu and Hokuchon, and even the recent story that came out of Jing Haizhan in WA, or in Tasmania, and the cases of the Chinese mother who was a worker who passed away in WA. You know, like, these are ongoing cases that represent the ongoing way that the government treat all of us, you know, like, to different extents. And so, and I think anyone who look at the coverage knows that these are murderers without even the verdict and the debate that's happening. And so, you know, like, this is, we're here to say that touch one, touch all. We're here to say that, you know, like, every worker deserve right. Every worker deserve a better condition and deserve to be in a position in which they can move through the world in a safe way. And every migrant deserve to have more rights. So yeah, I think this is an issue for all of us. You know, like, this is about our community uniting together to fight for a better world.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for that, Damien. And thank you for coming on the show to speak to us about the ongoing fight for justice for women like Yuko and other sex workers who have been killed and faced violence. And yeah, I'm sure we will be speaking to you or B or someone from Red Rising Lantern or Vixen again soon with updates on what's happening. But for now, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Yes, thank you very much for having me on.
We've been speaking to Damien about the ongoing violence against Asian migrant sex workers and the ongoing fight for justice for Yuko and other sex workers. You can follow Red Rising Lantern and Vixen on Instagram and can find more information and resources on Vixen's website, www.vixen.org.au. Before our next segment, we're going to go to a song. This is by Thelma Plum and it's called Better in Black.
Fuck.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and that was Thelma Plum with Better in Black. We are joined once again by Lucinda Thorpe, who is privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, and she joins us on the program this morning to discuss Australia's new online safety codes requiring age verification for R-rated games and websites and the consequences that this will have on our privacy. These new requirements aim to prevent children from being exposed to age-inappropriate content, raise questions about whether this will actually stop young people from accessing the content, as well as concerns regarding the online privacy of users. Welcome back to 3CR, Lucinda.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us back on the show. To start off with, could you please explain these new codes requiring users to verify their age before accessing websites and gaming sites that feature adult content, pornography, etc.?
Yep. So under the policy, porn sites and those adult gaming sites you mentioned must verify an Australian user's age by collecting information such as their government ID, bank details, face scans, or any other approved form of identification before the Australian user can view explicit material.
Yeah, and I guess this is similar to what we have been discussing before about age verification required for young people to access social media. And so can you tell us in a bit more detail the ways in which users can be asked to verify their age?
Yes. So the porn site can choose between a whole suite of different age verification methods, all of which have been approved by eSafety. All of these methods are so flawed. Let me read all of the approved methods out for you. So there's confirmation by a parent of age. There's photo ID, so government ID. Facial age estimation, credit card checks, digital identity, wallets or systems, age inference, which is basically like an AI examines all of your cookies and then guesses your age, and third-party age assurance vendors. So I'm just going to rattle off some of the issues with this here. Firstly, what kid is ever going to ask their parents to verify their age to watch porn? That is such an out-of-touch solution. And there's no way to verify who is really a parent. So who is actually providing that verification that the kid is of age to watch pornography? Second, kids can get access to credit cards and IDs that aren't theirs. It's easy to, you know, find someone's license or credit card lying around the house and then just use that. On third, age inference is so inaccurate. It's so inaccurate. And, like, what I do every day at work is try to prevent companies from being able to absolutely rot Australian data and try to put in place privacy reform, because there's no real reason that they need that data other than selling you things. Mm. But age inference creates a legal excuse for these websites and other services to collect that data on individuals, because they can now say, oh, it's to help support the implementation of laws. It's for law enforcement purposes. So it entrenches not just de-identification of the internet, but also the internet as a mechanism of surveillance on individuals.
Mm. Yeah, there's so many issues that you've brought up just now regarding this age verification methods. I don't even know where to begin, but I guess you were saying just now that, you know, it's quite, if you're using methods such as using ID or credit cards, like, it's quite easy for underage people to be able to find that lying around, like you said, and still use it, or use fake IDs and things like that. I was wondering, what are the concerns around, you know, pushing people to unregulated sites or apps in order to access adult content? I imagine that those platforms do exist?
Yep, 100%. So research shows that age verification for pornographic sites is effective in preventing accidental exposure, but as we've seen with the social media ban, age verification is an ineffective barrier. If kids want to access something, they're going to get to it. And there's limited evidence that, you know, exposure to this content alone can cause the harms that, you know, the advocates to this policy are claiming that it will. But anyway, research instead consistently shows that comprehensive sex education is the most effective way for young people to develop healthy relationships with sex. So if they seriously want to prevent the harms like violence against women, which is so important to address, that is how they should be doing it. Now, your question focused on young people, but I do just want to address that this mandate forces all Australians, not just young people, to choose between accessing legal content and preserving their online anonymity. So for many people, that trade-off is unacceptable, and as a result, users of all ages, not just young people, may simply migrate to those unregulated websites that ignore Australian law entirely. These websites could potentially host more extreme material, or they could have worse privacy protections. These are the kind of risks that this policy is exposing not just young people to, but everyone.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Lucinda, I guess, because this has been framed as a way to prevent children and underage people from accessing pornographic and other explicit material. I forgot that actually everyone is going to have to use these age assurances in order to verify whether they are over 18 or not. I think the idea of anonymity on the internet, I think, is something more and more that a lot of people are talking about, because like you said, surveillance is a big issue there, and also, you know, the mining of people's data. So I was wondering if we could end on that note. What privacy concerns do you have in users engaging with this age assurance, and what are the risks when it comes to companies who have access to this personal data, whether that's the platforms themselves or, I think you mentioned before, third parties who might be delivering these age verification methods?
Yeah. So in practice, age verification systems don't work, like I mentioned earlier, but just because they're ineffective in achieving their stated goal doesn't mean that they can't pose real risk to Australian privacy, or I guess privacy anywhere. So you're so right to ask this question. Age verification systems are operated by the websites themselves. So many smaller sites may lack the resources or the technical expertise to properly secure this extremely sensitive data that they're collecting. This could include the bank details, government identification, face scans of Australians attempting to access adult content. If these databases were breached and that information was exposed publicly or exploited for blackmail, the consequences could be devastating. Another concern that I have around privacy here is that fraudulent websites may also imitate age verification systems in order to harvest personal information from unsuspecting users. And that's just on top of all of the privacy concerns, some of which I mentioned earlier, that are actually entrenched within the age verification systems themselves.
Yeah, and it's just part of like a growing discussion that you and I have had and you've had with other presenters on 3CR, just about more and more surveillance and more privacy concerns when it comes to our personal data, either being used by tech companies, or at risk of data breaches, not just on the online space, but just through surveillance in shopping centres and other spaces as well. So I think, I guess every time that there's a story that comes out like this, it's really important to keep a close eye and really question whether how effective these measures are and whether it's for the greater good of all of our privacy. Just quickly, Lucinda, if there are people who are really concerned about this, they want to find more, where can they go for more information?
Fantastic question. So please head over to our website, Digital Rights Watch. Just Google us and we're the first ones that come up. We have explainers on this. We also have a newsletter which will keep you updated on all the similar kind of tech policies coming out, which you might not be aware are coming up. eSafety is the one administering this policy. So if you want to hear directly from them, head to their website and they will tell you about the approved mechanisms for age verification. They probably won't tell you about the risks associated. So if you want to hear about them, head on over to our website.
Yeah, amazing. Well, thank you so much for that, Lucinda. And thank you again for contributing regularly to our show and just making sure that listeners stay informed about their rights and what the risks are when using online platforms. So, yeah, we really appreciate your time this morning.
It is always a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
So that was Lucinda Thorpe speaking to us about the new online safety codes that will require age verification for explicit games and websites. To follow the work that Digital Rights Watch is doing to fight for our rights online, head to digitalrightswatch.org.au. And while today's discussion looked at the impact that these age assurances would have on users, we have not yet discussed the impacts that this would have on sex workers who work using digital platforms. Scarlet Alliance, which I mentioned earlier, they're the national peak body for sex workers in so-called Australia. They have published some information about why these new codes will harm workers. This includes the exposure of workers and clients to privacy and safety risks, but there are others. So for more information on that, you can go to scarlet_alliance on Instagram or scarletalliance.org.au. We'll be back in a few minutes with our next interview, but for now, here's another song. This is Letting Go by Angie McMahon.
I might have spent 6 months lying on my living room floor. I might have been sick then, well then sick some more. I might be proud of me than I ever have been. I've been learning about letting go, how to do it without my clothes scratching the surfaces. I've been learning about wasting time and closing some doors, hoping to open more down the line. I knew from miles away that I would detonate. I tried some magic tricks to skip my fate.
It's okay, make mistakes, it's okay. It's okay, make mistakes, make mistakes. It's okay, it's okay.
Up next, we are speaking to Catherine Noon, an organiser from the Save Our Community Health campaign. Last October, the government announced cuts to inner city co-health services in Kensington, Fitzroy and Collingwood. And then in November, $1.5 million was provided to the co-health services to keep them afloat until July. Catherine is here to share how these cuts have affected the range of services available and the impact that this has had on the community and what's next for the campaign. Welcome to Tuesday Breakfast, Catherine.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you getting up early in the morning to chat to us. Late last year we did hear that there were major cuts announced to the co-health services. Can you start off by, talking us through how that's impacted the range of services offered at these clinics?
Sure. And just to say that I'm from the group that's called Save Our Community Health.
Yeah.
And we're a group of people who we all use co-health services. People have been involved in different ways over the years and we get no funding. We're not part of any political party, but we're just here to make sure our community stands up for our community. Since the cuts were announced, co-health keeps telling us that they're still going to close. So I don't know if you've rung up lately to try and get an appointment, but the message goes for ages and it basically tells you it's going to be really hard to get an appointment, that appointments are limited. If you go online to their website to try and book an appointment, you can't book to see a doctor at Collingwood or Fitzroy or Kensington. They've also continued to go through with some of the announced closures that they had said they would do despite the independent review. So in December, they sacked the counselling staff. People who were accessing general counselling services were told to finish up or told to go and get mental health services elsewhere or at different parts of co-health. And then at the end of January, they closed the pharmacy services. And these are community health services that used to be community run. And so many people who are part of the campaign have been patients for decades, who have been on the board, who've been staff, and we're all feeling really excluded from an organisation that was meant to be about our involvement and how it's run. And can I do a brief bit about the history of it?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So part of the, particularly for Collingwood, we've got a super long history of providing health services in the area for people in a way that meets the needs of the area. And that started in 1869 with Dr. Wow. Singleton. So the Dr. Singleton, it was the Singleton Medical Centre and Dispensary, and it offered free or low-cost medical services. And that was because there were a lot of people in the area who needed those services who weren't able to access them. And it even connects to the first woman who was registered as a doctor in Australia. She's registered in 1890 and she comes down and she's volunteering and running services through Singleton's clinic. She apparently was seeing up to 60 to 100 patients a day. We are definitely not promoting that as the community health model for now, but that was what was needed at the time to help people. And then it adapted obviously 50 years ago and became these community health services, and the Singleton Dispensary was on Wellington Street in Collingwood, and then part of the move of setting up Collingwood Community Health was moving to Hoddle Street and having that all set up. So it's been a lot of community services adapting to how the community needs the services to be over a really long time. So we really want to make sure we keep that.
Yeah, it sounds like it's been a very long history of serving the community, and it has such a long legacy as well. And I think with that in mind, it does seem like the recent cuts are really monumental, but could you speak to what impact this has had on the community?
Sure. I mean, for everyone who was part of it, so many people turned up in October when there was that first public meeting at the Fitzroy Town Hall organised by the Mayor and Deputy Mayor of City of Yarra, and that was fantastic to see that our community shows up when we need to protect our community services like the pool and all the things we've done together. But everybody's worried and we're scared, and like every time I've been to an appointment at Collingwood recently, there have been people crying. People who are worried about losing jobs, people who are worried about losing access to services, and also that loss of community connection because, well, I mean, we know that over 12,000 people are accessing the services, and that's a big loss for people. And if people are going to have to go to new doctors, they've got to start again, tell their story again, build new relationships, find new places. And also we know it's going to put extra pressure on the public health at the hospitals and emergency services. But we know that we've got people in the community who have multiple health concerns, and they've been scared to leave the house because if they go out and something goes wrong, they might not be able to get in and see their doctor.
Mm.
The services at CoHealth have been being continually run down and less access to services is available. As I said, it's hard to get appointments. We feel that the services aren't really encouraging people to still be there because they're still telling us it's going to close, even though government has announced this review to try and keep it going and make a sustainable option for the future. So we want to make sure that people aren't feeling unsafe, that they've got somewhere they can still go for support. We also have people who are visiting regularly, bringing food for the staff and showing the staff. We know that the staff who deliver the services at CoHealth, at Fitzroy, at Kensington, at Collingwood, they're amazing. And we love them and we want to support them. And so people have been turning up with food for them. People are writing letters of support. And so that's been really beautiful, that community connection there and showing how much people really do care. But we've got to make sure that those wraparound services stay. And that community connection part is a really big part of it. I think some of our concerns have been that a lot of this discussion has turned into what's happening to the GP services and the funding for GP services. But community health isn't just doctors.
Yeah, I think that's a really important part of it. And yeah, what you said, Catherine, as well, about how a lot of people accessing these services, they're not just seeing one service, they're seeing a range of them to tackle their health beyond just physical health as well. I know we spoke to Kim, who was a community health user, and she really spoke to that fear that she had, and I think that a lot of other people have as well, of not having access to that comprehensive kind of healthcare that she needed. I know that last November the government gave the CoHealth services $1.5 million to keep the doors open. Could you speak to where that $1.5 million has gone?
It's a good question. We're all still trying to find out. We hope that we'll get some answers soon. But that $1.5 million, the actual announcement was that it would continue CoHealth's general practice services. So that's where we had that bit of a red flag. Is this only about doctors? It said it would help continue the services until the 31st of July this year. And that's why we're also worried that CoHealth are continuing to say to people it's closing when we're not at July yet.
Mm.
And we haven't had the outcomes of the review. So the other part of that announcement was that government would do an independent review run by Stephen Duckett to find out what's been going on at CoHealth, to look at the governance, to look at the management. And all of that paperwork and all of those announcements said it was about finding a long-term solution.
Mm.
So it doesn't really make sense to us that CoHealth is still trying to shut down the services when everything we understand about that funding was about making sure that this keeps going, and we want to make sure that government at every level honour that and make sure it does keep going for all of us and for future generations. And so we don't really know where the money's gone, but we'd like to find out.
Yeah, definitely. And I know that there's supposed to be an independent review into community health that should be coming out soon. Could you talk us through what this report is and what you're hoping to find out from it?
Yeah, so as you can all imagine, the independent review, I know a lot of people submitted. They had over 300 submissions, which was amazing because it was over the December-January period, when I'm sure they didn't expect that many people to be involved, but we all care. And because of that, the independent review panel actually asked for an extra couple of weeks to do their final report. So our understanding is that the final report has been given, at least to the federal minister, and it'll be shared with the federal minister, the state and local members, as well as CoHealth. but we believe that was all delivered last week, but we don't know where it is now, and we don't currently have a commitment that they will share those findings, and we want to know what's going on because, as we said, community health is meant to be community-led and part of the community, so we want to know what's going on so that we can make sure this continues, or if the recommendations are saying something that doesn't mean it'll continue, what can we do to make sure we can find another solution?
Yeah, definitely. I think it is so important to know what's actually in the report, to know, kind of where we're at and what to do next. But yeah, in the months ahead, what is the focus of the Save Our Community Health campaign going to be?
Well, we're really keen, as I said, to find out what the report says. And we want to make sure that every level of government is committed to keeping the community health centres open at Fitzroy, at Collingwood, at Kensington. And we want to make sure that there's funding because community health gets funding from state and federal governments. And we want to make sure that it's a community health model that isn't just about providing health in the community, but it's a whole, as you said earlier, that whole comprehensive, holistic wraparound services. Mm. We want to make sure that the funding is there to make sure that really does happen, that this doesn't turn into a GP clinic because that would be a terrible outcome. Mm. We don't want to go back to Constance Stone seeing 60 patients a day.
Yeah.
We want to make sure that we're doing that whole service for people. We want to also make sure that the community health services are well managed. Previously, like a lot of people part of this campaign have been on the board, have been part of those decisions in the past. Mm. And we were all so shocked when this decision was announced in October and we hadn't had any warning and we weren't part of that. And it's an organisation that everybody feels so part of, but we don't anymore. Mm. And so we want to make sure that whatever happens, that the management of it and the accountability and things will make sure this we don't end up in this situation again. So I'm sure there'll be recommendations about governance and all of those kind of things and accountability in the independent review findings. But we also want to make sure that they don't sell the Collingwood site. That's another thing that's been particularly concerning for us, that we've got that site in Collingwood. And there was a plan before COVID about renovating
yeah.
Renovating that building, making sure that it had housing as well as community health services on the site. And I mean, that would be an amazing outcome. So we want to make sure that things like that come back on the table and that we're actually getting something that keeps that there and provides all of that those services around everything that we need, because health promotion, health education, community health prevention, it's about so much more than just the doctor's services. So if you had housing on site as well, what a great way to be that hook into all the things that people can access.
Yeah, definitely. And could you point our listeners where to go to if they want to find out more about the campaign?
Yeah, we'd love you to be involved. We'd love you to join our mailing list because, as we said, we're hoping that there will be something released. We want to make sure that the Minister for Health has pressure about asking her to rebuild the Collingwood site. We want to make sure there's funding for the future. So if you could join our mailing list, and we'll let you know as soon as we know what's happening next. Our email address is savecommunityhealth@gmail.com, or one word, savecommunityhealth@gmail.com. And we'll be having public meetings as soon as we know what's going on, and they'll be in the next few weeks, we hope. So please email us, get on our mailing list and be part of it, because we know what we can do together. We'll make sure we save this together. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. We'll definitely encourage people to join. And yeah, we've been speaking to Catherine Noon, organiser at Save Our Community Health Campaign, about the ongoing fight to protect and fund community health amidst recent cuts. And up next, we're going to play a song called Sway by the band Fair Trade Narcotics.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinnana. I'm a proud Yorta Yorta, Jaja Rong, Kalkadoon and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
Melbourne, we are stronger together. Join with unionists, people of faith, young people and refugees to affirm the strength of our diverse communities. We all need to feel a sense of belonging and be assured of justice and fair treatment. Come along to Stronger Together, Palm Sunday, 29th of March. Gather on Prince's Bridge at 1 p.m. with banners and placards, then walk to Birrarung Mar Lower Terrace. There'll be speakers and music from 2 p.m. We walk to embrace and celebrate our differences, say no to all cruelty and injustice, and stand up for freedom and peace. See you on the bridge. Stronger Together, Palm Sunday, the 29th of March from 1 p.m. Search for Stronger Together on Facebook for more information. Refugee Advocacy Network is a 3CR supporter.
Melbourne Food and Wine Festival hosts Feast for Freedom with the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre for one night only. Join us for an exclusive communal dining experience at the ASRC's Home of Hope in Footscray on Wednesday the 25th of March. Share a long table feast created by refugee chefs from Palestine and Sri Lanka. Celebrate incredible food and help raise vital funds for people seeking asylum. Tickets are limited. Book now at feastforfreedom.org.au/MFWF. Feast for Freedom is an initiative of the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, a 3CR supporter.
Accented women.
It seems so obvious to me that if you live in a completely violent cultural milieu, that it's going to translate into every aspect of women's lives.
Accented women.
What's a border? They don't see it like a big wall right along the...
How can people live ordinary lives when they're living in such an extraordinary situation where there are armies there and terrorists there, such conflict every single day of their lives?
Accented women.
A show by and about women from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds.
On Community Radio 3CR.
Your station, your voice.
Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan.
Welcome to Rainbows Don't Fade with Age on Radio 3CR.
Welcome to Trans Creator Radio.
Queer histories, queer futures, it's an audio journey into the
Trans Day of Audibility, a day for us to be heard and not seen.
3CR, your station, your voice.
We are joined in the studio today by lead singer Brooke Kimberly of Fair Trade Narcotics. Today we'll be speaking about their upcoming album titled Recession Pop. It's a bit of a melting pot with rock, jazz, psychedelia, and early 2000s pop production. They lean into soulful vocals and strong songwriting with horns and keys adding color, plus two guitars and a rhythm section that keeps everything driving. This is their second album coming out this April 4th. Welcome to 3CR, Brooke.
Hey. Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'm so glad to talk to you today about this album. You describe your music as a mix of quite a lot, and I'm wondering, how did this combination come together?
Kind of came about very organically. We didn't set out to cross-pollinate into so many different styles, but it's always been a bit of an experimental beast Fairtrade has as a band. So I'm kind of just blessed with bandmates that are willing to give any kind of song I bring to the group a crack, because most of the music is it's songs that I will have like penned in my own spare time, and then I bring in the bones and we flesh it out as a group. We do group arrangements as well, but we were just willing to give everything a go. Yeah. And that's why there is so much stylistic crossover, I think, as well, because we all come from different backgrounds in music, and, you know, it's as a sum of our parts being six different members, and we all bring our own different stylistic inclinations. I think that's maybe where a lot of the crossover comes into play.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of backgrounds, how did all of those influences reflect your musical backgrounds as well as your bandmates and the scenes that you come out of?
True. So I think we've all sort of pulled into the one scene here in Nam, Melbourne. We've gigged a little bit interstate, but I'd say for the most part we are all pretty active in the local Melbourne scene as far as gigging. Some of the cross-pollination in style probably also comes from the fact that I was a trumpet player for a long time before I picked up singing and then later guitar. So I grew up playing swing and bossa standards on trumpet. But I was like doing a lot of prog and rock roots songwriting, and George and Luca have got like a background in kind of like psych, you know, these are boys that loved Tame Impala and Pond, and like was right into the psych stuff. So they're the kind of people who've just put in their 20,000 hours on their instruments.
Yeah.
So where we might have differed like stylistically in some ways, like I think we both, the three of us got jamming together through, I guess, a mutual love of of like psychedelic sort of like prog rock and like psych rock that was like pretty popular, like I guess in the era of like King Giz like taking over the whole music scene. And we were all like very inspired by that wave of musicians. The trombone player and I have like been collaborators for a long time. We met in an old funk band, which dissolved during COVID, but we persevered. He was leaving the band and I was kind of leaving, and I said, do you want to come with me instead and do this thing? And he's like, yeah, of course I do. And I'm like, so we kept our friendship going, kept playing music together. And I think the thing that's probably been the catalyst was Wilson, who can't be here this morning. They've got more of a jazz background. So when they bring their bass playing into play, that they've got a very jazz informed like way of playing, and that really complemented like I guess our like psych pop and rock styles. So, and it also made the music way jazzier rather than rockier. So whilst we still have a little bit of the thrash and the grit kind of element, I think they legitimize the jazz part of the playing.
Yeah, it all comes together really nicely, and with a 6-piece band, that is a really large band and so many elements. How do you keep the music sounding cohesive rather than crowded?
We practice every week. We'll be practicing tonight, so that's a non-negotiable for me. Because I've been running the project for a long time. So we get together every Tuesday night, and usually we allow about an hour for like designated hangout time, like chats, beers, cigarettes, and then from about 6 till 9, that's our 3 hours to just like punch in, run our material, or do workshopping, songwriting, whatever it is that we want to work on. But we're always going in with a plan, and we never practice without a reason. Usually it's always because we've got either a gig on the horizon or we've got recording booked coming up. So I think we always just make sure that we've got goals to work towards, and that keeps us accountable for showing up and putting in the time together.
Yeah, definitely. And when you're writing these songs, when you're workshopping and doing that kind of thing, does it usually start with a groove or a melody or something else?
Oh, it kind of depends on the songs, because I want to say it's probably a 70-30 split as far as like songs I bring to the group, which I've usually penned on guitar first. And I'm responsible for a lot of the chord progressions in the songs, and then like the vocal melodies and all the horn lines are usually something I sing. And if I'm singing and playing guitar, I can't physically play trumpet at the same time. So I'll get Dermot to play that on trombone. And where possible, I'll like try and double up with him. But then with some of the group arrangements, particularly on Recession Pop, we've got, I think, track 3 and 4 are predominantly instrumentals, and there's some progressions that George, the other guitarist in Fairtrade, brought to the group. And that's where I was just doing trumpet and maybe like a little smattering of vocals here and there. But it's largely like, I guess, like start with a groove. George and Luca have been playing together for over 10 years, so they're the kind of guys that like they've had a long running friendship since they were like teenage boys, and they're almost like 29 now. So they've got that instinctual kind of musicality where if one of them plays something, the other one is just simpatico follows. So we all kind of just feed off each other in that way. Can't stop jamming.
Was it difficult to navigate? I know you say that, you know, a couple of you were in different groups, knew each other prior, and I feel like that can bring kind of, you know, if two people know each other and two people know each other and come together into a 6-piece group, did you have to navigate that a little bit?
I think sometimes with it being now bar myself and Wilson, it can be very mask space sometimes. Yeah. But these are all people that I handpicked for the group as well. So like they're, you know, my best friends, bandmates and whatever. So sometimes it's like I've got to really like put a fist in the air and be like, all right, too many voices at once. We've got to narrow it down. But I think it's nice having 6 people. I like having an even amount of people. There's lots of complementary energies. We can either break off into 3s or into 2s if we need to like workshop anything. And everyone has their own distinct relationship with each other. The sixth member that I haven't mentioned yet in this chat is Jules, who joined us in the last year or so on keys. And he is originally from Sydney, and his first gig when he came to Melbourne before he started working at Bar Open was he saw a Fairtrade show. So
wow.
He was familiar with our music before he met us, and so was Wilson. Like, they'd heard of the band, like, or seen us before we'd properly met or later got playing together. So
yeah.
I think there's always just been a bit of a mutual understanding. We didn't have to, like... It's also just kind of like the older you get, the easier it is to maintain new friendships,
definitely.
I think. You don't have to do as much groundwork. You've all done it before.
Yeah. And it's nice with, I feel like the music community or live community here is a bit interlinked. Everybody knows someone that knows someone. So it's good that even though you come from separate backgrounds, maybe that when you came together, it's like, oh, you already knew our music. You already knew. So that's really cool. My first experience with you guys was stumbling into a gig that you happened to be opening for. But for someone with fresh eyes or fresh ears, what can someone expect when they come and see Fairtrade Narcotics?
Expect the unexpected. I like that one. I think come in knowing that it is a crossover of different styles. So I've been summarizing it as like psych, jazz, rock, and pop as a blend of those things. It's not a comprehensive list, but we're a band of friends, and we're doing what we do because we like to do it, and that's what we're here to share.
Yeah. And with Recession Pop, with this second album, what did you learn from your first album that you will now bring into this or have brought into the second album and into anything upcoming?
Oh, that is a good question. So the first album was kind of like documenting a lot of songs and ideas that we'd performed live and then recorded after the fact, with maybe with the exception of like a song like Cerulean, which happened, like we maybe wrote that maybe a month before recording it. It was very instantaneous.
Wow.
And I think it's still probably one of our better songs for that reason. It just had that fresh energy. But with this album, something that was really different about Recession Pop was we were kind of writing and recording and arranging all simultaneously. This is a lot more of a experimental and produced record than our last work. Like, we've always leaned into the kind of experimental, psychedelic, like audio production style. But I think with this one, I'm not going to do it next time because we've got another EP that we recorded in Clunes with a different engineer.
Yeah.
And that was all done live and with like very minimal overdubbing, or if there were overdubs, they were just for flavor.
Yeah.
Whereas Recession Pop has been like 18 months of meticulous building up, tearing down sections, adding lots of stuff in post and like really layering it up to be this sonic art piece. And I think we're going to do things a lot more sort of live and instantaneous for the next record to free ourselves up a little bit, because we've done this, we've gone through this experimental arc now, because that's how we were treating this album, was this is an experiment. And the name Recession Pop, like, is kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing, because Recession Pop's used to describe like an era of Y2K kind of 2000s music that was really overproduced and hooky and poppy, and had this underlying theme of let's go to the pub to drink and smoke and forget about all our problems. And I thought that with Recession Pop applied to an indie band from Melbourne was like pretty funny to me. So that's where that title comes from. But I think we'll definitely pull back as far as overproducing the next record.
Yeah,
for not for any stylistic reason, but just for our own sanity, so it doesn't take as long this time.
Yeah, it's definitely a process. Everything you do, you know, have something to learn, which I think is really cool. And yeah, I know with this upcoming album release, you have a little bit of a mini tour happening. But what role has this local Melbourne Narm scene done for you as a band or shaping you as a musician?
I don't think we'd be a band if it wasn't for the scene, to be honest. I've been running Fairtrade something like 8 years Yeah, it'll be 8 years this year, and everyone in the group has joined it like different times.
Yeah.
Like, because we've got, I think Will and Jules would be our most recent members, but it is really the scene that gave us a start, because we had our first gigs, you know, playing to seven people upstairs at like Gasso or something like that. And I think we've probably played just about every dive in Melbourne now. So I don't think we'd be anywhere without it. And I am really grateful that it's not perfect by any means. It is still pretty much the Wild West out there sometimes. But there's something to be said for the fact that people who just have ideas, no matter what their stylistic inclination, they can just give it a crack, you know? And they can just get out there and just start booking, start doing shows and start experimenting.
Yeah.
So I think we owe everything to the scene for making us the musicians that we are. Like, it's how you cut your teeth and it's how you grow that tenacity to keep showing up even when you have a crap show or you have a really great one, or you have one where there's not so many people and then one where it's packed out, you know. It's the ups and downs. You get ready to just bring whatever it is you're doing, and you're going to be doing your thing regardless of the outcome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think for a band like Fairtrade, it is a turtle race, and we are fully in it for the process rather than any specific outcome.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been really great to talk to you about your music and this album. I'm really excited. Coming out on April 4th at the John Curtin Hotel. So for anybody listening, go check it out.
Yeah. Can I chime in real quick and say we've got Franz, Echo Social Club and Dakini Cuddle playing. They're three really, really top tier bands. So it's going to be super fun. And Algebra is also going to be doing interstitial DJing between sets as well. We'll see you there.
Yeah.
Kafirs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kafir to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kufias.org.au. That's kufias.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
That was Sway by Fair Trade Narcotics. That was Sway by Fair Trade Narcotics. We've just been speaking to Brooke, the lead singer, and now we've got up next Avril Burrows, who is a multidisciplinary artist with a focus on ceramics and also a mental health worker. Avril joins us today to discuss her exhibition Ochre Ritual, which is currently on show at Trocadero Project in Footscray. We talk about the history and cultural meaning behind the vegetable, which is the focus of our show, and how she used okra to create a range of works across mediums. Further, Avril contemplates the link between her art and mental health practice, and how both explore themes of repetition and repair.
Accented women. It seems so obvious to me that if you live in a completely violent cultural milieu, that it's going to translate into every aspect of women's lives.
Accented women. What's a border? They don't see it like a big...
Thank you so much for joining us today. Could you start off by introducing yourself to our listeners?
My name's Avril, and I am an artist, an art therapist, and mental health social worker. I primarily practice in textiles and ceramics, but the exhibition at the moment kind of spans a number of different methods.
Yeah, awesome. And yeah, definitely having visited the exhibition myself, I could definitely see that your exhibition was spanning a lot of different mediums. Could you talk us through the exhibition for listeners who might not have seen it?
So the exhibition is about bindi, which is okra. Bindi is in Hindi. It basically surrounds the history and culture of the vegetable, which sounds really funny at the start, but as I started researching and understanding it, a lot of information comes out about how it was used and how it's traveled around the world and the way it's grown, et cetera. And so I've tried to use it as my muse, really, and use different materials to express how it's been seen and understood around the world. Within the exhibition, you'll see some photographic images. You'll see a video work where I'm cooking okra with my family. You'll see some printing, some lino printing on textiles of what the plant looks like. See some weaving done with, I've made fiber out of the okra stalks. And you'll also see lots of ceramic okras that have all been handmade.
Fantastic. And one thing I really liked was those handmade okra ceramic pieces. They were at the start of the exhibition and people could pick them up and then, yeah, be handling them in their hands as they're walking through the exhibition, which I thought was a really nice touch.
It was really important for me to have those present, I think, because I'd made so many and I know what it feels like in my hands. And I wanted people to have the same experience of, like, the weight and the texture and the feel of them. And so, yeah, I hope that was really lovely to hold as you walked through.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess I'd be interested to know a bit more about, you know, you've obviously selected okra as the focus of your exhibition. What does it mean to you personally and culturally?
Look, there was this moment a couple of years ago, my partner had organized for Mother's Day, my mum and dad to come over and cook me my favorite meal. It was a very cute Mother's Day present. But I remember watching them all in the kitchen, my kids and my parents, and kind of like transferring this knowledge over of like how to cook this food that my dad just has always made for me as I've been growing up. Like every time I go back home, he'd usually make some kind of waiting for me. And it's a food that I've grown up with. I don't think it's well understood. Not a lot of people know how to cook with it. Not a lot of people know how to eat it. And you usually get kind of a funny face from people when they go, oh, have you tried this? And they're like, oh, it's a bit slimy. I don't think it's, you know, something I, you know, go back to. But this was kind of a way of, yeah, it just opened this light up in me as I started exploring it, especially its history, and then started growing it as well. And so, yeah, it just started going on this like pretty epic journey when I got into it.
Yeah, you can really, I think, see that through the works as well, because you're kind of exploring so many different facets of it as well. And that was really cool to see how in the video work you are engaging with the vegetable with your family. And yeah, you mentioned at the start that you have a background working in mental health. How has that informed your practice?
One of a foundational element of practicing mental health has been recovery, repetition, and routine. It's something that I try and embed in my mental health work, where we know people, when they have some routine and there's repetition, the body regulates itself. Wow, there's a lot of R's in this process. Body really regulates itself when it can kind of predict what's happening. And so part of my practice has been to incorporate those methods of repair when there are, you know, when there is trauma there. Yeah, so I think that with the ochres, especially the ceramic ochres, I can do it with my eyes closed now. Like, it's so embodied as a, like a muscle memory process. That repetition of doing a few every day has became, like, I guess over the last 2 years, quite a grounded experience for me, of just having the bag of clay there. And then I just go, I do as many as I could within like a few hours or 20 minutes. And yeah, it became quite a interesting routine as part of the whole process. But yeah, the repetition is probably something that I find moves my art practice and mental health practice together.
As an artist myself, I think it has been the projects that I've done where you are creating that very repetitive work that you can really sort of get into the rhythm, and that, yeah, it can become quite therapeutic working on something again and again. And yeah, having that comfort and familiarity as well is so important. And yeah, I think it also creates a very visually stunning exhibition as well, because you do get to see this shape repeated throughout the exhibition, but then also seeing it from different angles as well in your prints. And when you made the prints, did you actually, was that using the ochre as a stamp? How did that work?
Yeah, so there's one print in specific where I've, yeah, sliced the ochre and I've used that as a stamp. And I got pretty obsessed with the shape. It's like a hexagonal floral shape that comes out. And every ochre obviously looks very different. And it, the method of choosing which shape was like worthy enough to be a print was really funny. Yeah, just the repetition of the shape. And culturally, it just had this real beautiful mosaic-y kind of elaborate feel to it, which is quite reminiscent of like Indian architecture as well. And I think there's the other textile print as well. And that has, it's this motif that's used across a lot of Indian textiles. It's like a symmetrical floral image. And so I really try to take like the ochre flowers and the ochre pods and stems and leaves and like turn it into that motif. Yeah, and that's repetitive as well, you know, the stamping of like a block printing, that method too. So yeah, kind of really got into the ochre space.
Yeah, it's a very dynamic vegetable for sure. And maybe to finish up, could you share, Avril, where our listeners can go to find out more about the exhibition?
So it's showing at Trocadero Projects at the moment, which is in Footscray on Leeds Street. And it's open till the 5th of April. And you can look up my Instagram, which is Avril_Burrows. And then there's a website link on there too, to have a look at the shops and, yeah, to have a kind of peruse around some of the projects that I've done.
Awesome. Thank you so much. We'll definitely encourage our listeners to go and see the show. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, so welcome. Thanks, Juliet.
That was an interview with Avril Burrows, artist and mental health worker, about her exhibition Ochre Ritual at Trocadero Projects. You can find out more at Trocadero Projects on Instagram or at Avril_Burrows. We've had a big show today. Starting off, we interviewed Damien from Vixen, who's part of the Asian Migrant Sex Worker Advisory Group. Then we spoke to Lucinda Thorpe from Digital Rights Watch. At 7:45, we chatted to Catherine from Save Our Community Health. And then we spoke to Brooke Kimberley from Fair Trade Narcotics, and finished with an interview with artist Avril Burrows. I think that's all we've got time for today. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.